Good morning. You're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Diane and John Luke, and we'll be reading from the Lowell Sun and Eagle Tribune, respectively. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Okay, lead-off story from the Eagle Tribune, which appears to be an opinion piece from John Manzo. On Super Bowl Sunday, there was a demonstration of the stark division in the United States as to which halftime show to watch. Early estimates tell us that close to 122 million people watched Bad Bunny, who performed at the Super Bowl, and 6 million people concurrently watched the Turning Point USA, TPUSA, presentation. Many watched it later. Additionally, many watched the Bad Bunny performance later. I'm not sure we'll ever really know how many people watched each thing. Before you get hung up on the statistics, I don't know if anyone knows these numbers for certain. Both performances were, on a hand, a huge success. Kate Miller, wife of Stephen Miller, recently interviewed Charlotte Jones, the co-owner of the Dallas Cowboys and daughter of Jerry Jones. Ms. Miller asked Mrs. Jones what Ms. Jones thought about Bad Bunny performing. The answer given shocked Katie Miller. Charlotte Jones was thrilled. She said a significant percentage of the Cowboys fan base was Latino, and she thought it was a great idea. I don't think it was the answer Katie Miller expected or wanted, but Charlotte Jones was accurate. I suspect that both Texan teams have a large Latino fan base. Miami does, and I would guess the other Florida teams do as well. The New York Giants and Jets played in New Jersey, and in the 1970s, the Latino population of New Jersey was 20%, not to mention New York City right across the river. Recognizing also that the largest cities in California have Spanish names, there is potentially a large fan base. Additionally, the NFL is looking to expand internationally, and one of their target cities is Mexico City, which is, at this point, the largest city in North America. It is estimated that in the United States, and I'm talking legal numbers, Spanish-speaking people total 60 million, or just under 20% of the population. The NFL, ever seeking to expand its fan base, drew a staggering high number of new viewers to their broadcast by having a performer perform in Spanish. While my Spanish is not remotely good enough to understand most of what he's saying, a large percentage of the population did. People, for the most part, liked his performance. The controversy aroused my curiosity, and I watched the entire thing. I'm a diehard football fan and actually watch the Super Bowl because I love football. My point is that choosing Bad Bunny, who just won multiple Grammy Awards and is very popular from a business perspective, was actually pretty smart. This Super Bowl, according to the ratings, was the second most watched Super Bowl, and the viewership went up at halftime. It was the second most watched halftime show ever. This is a rather incredible, considering most NFL fans found the matchup to be a rather uninteresting, and the game itself was a pretty one-sided affair and a defensive battle. In the football jargon, defense wins championships and offense sells tickets, which means an exciting offense duel would have been more interesting. TPUSA's show, from what I heard, was also quite good. People enjoyed it. Turning Point used time before the show to raise funds, and the show itself, based on the viewer comments, was entertaining and fun. The fact that Turning Point chose to do this, perhaps, is another question, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole because it further widens the stark divisions amongst us. I suspect if Bad Bunny performed and no one raised an alarm, this halftime performance would have been seen by less people and evaluated based on its merits instead. People who really do not enjoy it are professing their love for it, and people who might have liked it say it was awful. Likewise for the TPUSA performance. We collectively were triggered by rage baiting. Rage baiting is a tactic used to provoke strong emotional reactions, often anger or outrage, by presenting content that is controversial, inflammatory, or divisive, or in many instances, creating rage by baiting people to be infuriated by something inconsequential. We all have suckered into taking sides on, frankly, a nonsensical debate. Taking a step back, what major significance is it who performs at the Super Bowl? The performances are about 13 minutes. Honestly, if you asked me who performed in recent years, I could not tell you. In a world of major issues, the halftime performer does not make the top 100 issues. It does not make the top 1,000 issues. We got rage-baited by nonsense. I use the pronoun we intentionally, me too. I largely believe most people are basically decent and probably not as divided as many people in leadership positions desire us to be. We do, however, believe the stark divisions in our nation are staggering because, frankly, we have been bait-raged. So if you enjoyed Bad Bunny, I am happy for you. If you enjoyed the TPUSA show, I'm happy for you. In the end, the NFL won. Turning point won. Those of us who got ourselves twisted in knots lost. We got rage-baited into conflict. Perhaps it's time to stop taking the bait so easily. Johnny Manzo is a retired United Church of Christ pastor and adjunct professor at Ivy Tech Community College in Indiana. Okay. Susan.
Diane.
Diane. Oh.
Stadies launch probe of cover-up allegations. Out of the Boston Herald, the Massachusetts State Police hired an outside firm to review how the agency handled a fatal cruiser crash involving an allegedly drunk officer more than 2 years after the incident occurred. State Police Sergeant Scott Quigley is accused of having a blood alcohol level above the legal limit when he crashed his cruiser head-on into a wheelchair van in December of 2023, causing the injuries to one of its occupants, Angelo Schettino, who later died. The allegations came to light in a wrongful death suit that Schettino's family originally filed with Essex County against the van company that now includes the Mass State Police. The revelation has sent ripples through the state, pausing the Lowell murder trial of brothers Billy Chana and Beluyamum Fan earlier this month. Quigley had been a key investigator in the case when he was embedded with the Middlesex County District Attorney's Office. Middlesex DA Marion Ryan had asked the state police to initiate the independent investigation after learning about the fatality in the crash and Quigley's alleged blood alcohol level in January, more than 2 years after the incident. In the interest of transparency and in order to promote public confidence and to ensure justice for any potential victims, I am requesting that you immediately appoint an independent investigator to conduct a full and fair inquiry into why no notification was made to this office, she wrote in a February 4th letter to State Police Colonel Jeffrey Noble. In Noble's reply, dated February 20th, the state police boss wrote that investigators from the national firm 21CP Solutions will conduct a review focused on the handling of this incident and the internal policies and controls that should have ensured timely awareness and notification. The independent investigators will examine how the MSP currently handles serious on-duty incidents, including their notification process, supervisor response, and documentation policies. Notably, the independent investigation will not determine any criminal liability related to the case and associated events. A serious incident resulting in the loss of a life demands timely notification, rigorous oversight, and complete accountability, Noble wrote. Any deviation from these expectations is unacceptable, falls short of public expectations, and risks undermining confidence in the justice system. At the end of the review, the investigators will recommend changes to training, policy, and procedure. The review will run parallel to a Suffolk County District Attorney's Office investigation into Quigley, examining whether the officer will face criminal charges linked to the crash. In addition to the independent review, Noble noted that MSP also initiated internal affairs investigations involving specific individuals. We have also launched refresher training on serious injury and fatal crash protocols, escalation responsibilities, and documentation and recording standards, the colonel wrote, and strengthened conflict of interest screening for incidents involving MSP personnel with cross-agency assignments or relationships. Over to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Diane. looks like a time before goodbye, navigating elder care from the Eagle Tribune. Derry. Community caregivers of Greater Derry, with support from the Greater Derry Arts Council's Public Arts Committee, is pleased to bring a screening of the film Time Before Goodbye, Navigating Elder Care, as part of the award-winning Elephant in the Room series by the New Hampshire Theater Project to the Derry Opera House, 29 West Broadway, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. on March 9. Tickets are free, but attendees must register at navigatingeldercarefilm.eventbrite.com. The film addresses myths surrounding the elder care process, clarifies how healthcare and support systems operate, and highlights the challenges faced by both caregivers and patients. The work aims to offer clarity, reduce isolation, and raise awareness about resources that many families may not know exist. This free event features a 45-minute film presentation, followed by a facilitated discussion between the audience and a panel of experts, highlighting the issues and challenges brought up in the play. Community caregivers will be providing refreshments. Each attendant will receive a compiled set of resource materials from local providers, advocates, and helping agencies. To add your materials to the resource bags, or for any other questions, contact events@caregivers.org or 603-432-0877, extension 6. Danville Candidates Night. Danville Candidates Night, beginning at 7 p.m. on February 26th at the Community Center, 169 Main Street. Residents will have an opportunity to meet the candidates, hear their views, and get informed before the election. Sandown Oktoberfest vendor applications now open. Sandown Oktoberfest is now taking applications from vendors for this year's Oktoberfest, held from 12 p.m. to 10 p.m. October 17 at the Sandlot. Organizers are looking for food and baked goods, soaps, pottery, jewelry, homemade crafts, and anything in between. There is limited space for vendors, so early signups are encouraged. To apply, visit impossible URL, so you just have to look up the Sandown Oktoberfest. New Hampshire Ice Castles now open, North Woodstock. New Hampshire Ice Castles are now open in North Woodstock. The earliest date in history, the famous attraction has opened. Guests will be able to step into a world of magical wonder, exploring a landscape filled with ice slides, tunnels, and caverns. The experience features stunning new sculptures crafted by internationally renowned ice sculptors, along with the thrill of the tubing hill and enhanced features on the Mystic Light Walk and Sleigh Ride Trail. The Icy Fortress also features a frosty twist with the Frozen Tap Ice Bar, the coolest spot in town to enjoy beverages, and a one-of-a-kind ice bar experience. Guests can also warm up with hot drinks and indulge in sweet treats available at on-site concessions. Ice Castles plan to stay open extended hours over the holiday break. Tickets are on sale now at icecastles.com. Diane.
Okay, out of Merrimack, New Hampshire, DHS scraps plans for ICE facility. New Hampshire Governor Kelly Ayotte says Department of Homeland Security plans for a new ICE processing and detention center at a large warehouse in Merrimack have been called off. I'm pleased to announce that the Department of Homeland Security will not move forward with the proposed ICE facility in Merrimack, Ayotte posted on X on Tuesday, indicating that she spoke with DHS Secretary Kristi Noem during a trip to Washington, D.C. last week. I thank her for hearing the concerns of the town of Merrimack and for the continued cooperation between DHS and New Hampshire law enforcement to secure our northern border, keep dangerous criminals off our streets, and ensure our communities are safe, she said. The planned ICE facility sparked controversy in and around New Hampshire, with Ayotte expressing frustration with the DHS for an apparent lack of communication on the project to convert the former warehouse into a processing and detention center. The governor also criticized the state agency in comments made to New Hampshire Bulletin earlier this month for not informing the corner office about its communication communications with DHS and ICE on the planned facility. It is entirely unacceptable that the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources failed to share this information with the governor's office, an IOT spokesperson told the Bulletin. Clearly, the Department of Homeland Security is actively pursuing the use of this property without communicating with all stakeholders. We will continue to insist on transparency and communication from the Department of Homeland Security with officials in Merrimack concerning this proposed facility. Documents obtained by the ACLU included a letter dated January 9th from DHS to New Hampshire Division of Historical Resources listing the various site improvements planned for the property along with other aspects of the project. Proposed site improvements may include but are not limited to installing, upgrading, or rehabbing existing parking areas, fencing, site lighting, landscape, drainage and stormwater, recreation areas and cameras. Tentage and a guard shack may also be installed, the letter said. Drama over the facility spread to surrounding states, namely Massachusetts, after Governor Maura Healey issued a statement demanding that IOT do everything in her power to block the facility. We should be opposing ICE tactics, not allowing them to expand. We certainly should not be allowing ICE to build new human warehouses when they can't be trusted to keep people safe and protect due process. Healey said, I oppose this in the strongest possible terms, and I am demanding that Governor Ayotte do everything in her power to block a new ICE facility in southern New England. Healey continued her now routine criticism of ICE, pointing to the violence-filled operations carried out in Minnesota over the past several weeks and other actions across the country. ICE is shooting people dead on the street. Mothers have been ripped from cars and separated from children. U.S. citizens have been stopped, detained, or even killed. Peaceful protesters have been assaulted. Parents are afraid to send kids to school, go to church to seek health care, and report crimes. None of this makes people safer. It makes us all less safe, Healey said. Now, ICE wants to build a new 400-bed facility in southern New Hampshire to supercharge their horrific deportation tactics in our communities. This will impact people in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and across our region. Enough is enough, she said. The 43-acre former warehouse at 50 Robert Milligan Parkway in Merrimack was set to be converted into a new 400-bed detention facility, one of several large-scale facilities the agency is planning to erect across the country. New Hampshire Democrats voiced a strong opposition to the planned detention center when the Merrimack facility was included in a Washington Post report in December on ICE's plans for facilities across the country. Governor Ayotte has been the only New England governor to be public in support of ICE and President Trump's immigration crackdown, citing a law in 2025 that took effect this year, banning cities and towns from implementing sanctuary city policies. The Herald has reached out to IOT's office for comment. Over to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Diane. So more on ICE. ICE flight with 100 detainees stranded by blizzard in Portsmouth. Portsmouth, New Hampshire, a Omni Air international plane carrying about 100 immigration, customs, and enforcement detainees was stranded in a blizzard at Portsmouth International Airport starting at 1 a.m. Monday, giving only 15 minutes notice of arrival. The plane was still on the tarmac at 8 p.m. Monday, showing no signs of leaving soon, but the detainees had been allowed inside the terminal after 12 or 13 hours. Peace Development Authority spokesman Tiffany Eddy said any operational questions about this flight should be directed to Port City Air, PCA, the ground handler, and Omni Air. They didn't answer the phone. Portsmouth International Airport, PSM, was not advised that this flight was inbound despite our proactive outreach prior to the storm to account for all land airlines planning to use the airport, Eddy said. Had we been informed in advance of their intent to land at PSM during the blizzard, we would have strongly advised against it and encouraged them to divert to another airport not being impacted by this severe winter storm, Eddy said. John Corbett, Governor Kelly Ayotte's spokesman, didn't respond to in-depth NH Lowell.org's request for comment, but he did tell the media that Aya was aware of the grounded flight and said she had been in contact with Pease Development Authority and was tracking the situation. Stephanie Shaheen of Portsmouth, a Democratic candidate for the 1st District Congressional seat, said, "From the proposed human warehouse in Merrimack to this grounded flight at Pease, ICE's glowing footprint in New Hampshire is defined by poorly planned and reckless actions. DHS once again failed to communicate with local officials and are refusing to provide even the most basic answers to the public," Stephanie Shaheen said. Kim Herdman Shapiro, spokesman for No Ice NH, said the last-minute landing during a blizzard really shook a lot of people up to see an example like this. Joe Jordan of No Ice NH said, "This incident is a textbook example of ICE's operational cruelty and rank incompetence. To force a flight into a blizzard shows a complete disregard for the safety of the flight crew and the airport ground staff. To leave human beings warehoused on a tarmac for hours reveals a system that does not see them as people. This is not simply a logistical error. It is a feature of ICE's inhumane mission." No Ice New Hampshire is a grassroots coalition of volunteer organizations working together to support the immigrant community and oppose unlawful and inhumane immigration enforcement practices. New Hampshire's congressional delegation, Senators Jean Shaheen, Maggie Hassan, and Congressman Maggie Goodlander and Chris Pappas, all Democrats, didn't respond to request for comment from indepthnh.org. Diane.
Okay, State of the Union, sitting this one out. Presley, McGovern, Clark, Trahan join Markey in State of the Union boycott. Several members of the Massachusetts federal delegation say they will not attend the State of the Union address Tuesday night, joining Senator Ed Markey, Democrat from Massachusetts, in boycotting the event in protest against President Trump. On Tuesday, Democratic Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, District 7, Lori Trahan, Mass. District 3, House Minority Whip Catherine Clark, Mass. District 5, and Congressman Jim McGovern, Mass. District 2, announced they will instead be attending the People's State of the Union, a counter-programming demonstration against the president. "The state of our union is traumatizing our children, and that is because of the violent rhetoric and policies enacted by the occupant of the Oval Office," Pressley said in a video posted on X on Tuesday. "That's why I'm boycotting #SOTU tonight, and my honorary guests are children who've been directly harmed and impacted by ICE." McGovern also announced his intent to skip the address on X, calling Trump's speech a manifesto of mistruths in one post on Monday. "I've gone to every State of the Union since I was elected to Congress, including Trump's first term. I'd rather stick needles in my eyes than listen to his manifesto of mistruths," McGovern said, also posting a video of himself speaking on the House floor Tuesday, bashing Trump's claimed economic accomplishments. In a statement, Tron said she respects the tradition of the State of the Union before citing what she calls Trump's empty promises as a reason for not going. "While I respect the tradition of the State of the Union and the office of the president, I will not attend Donald Trump's speech tonight," said Tron. "Families across our country are facing higher prices at the grocery store, on their utility bills, and at the pharmacy. The last thing they want to hear is more empty promises from a president who has spent the past year enriching himself and his billionaire donors while hardworking Americans struggle to make ends meet," she said. Clark, whose role during the State of the Union address is to manage, monitor, and unify party members' attendance and reactions, says she's in boycotting the address to instead listen to her constituents on the topic of affordability. "Rather than listen to Donald Trump lie to the American people, I will be hearing from the people of my district about their personal experiences with skyrocketing costs, new barriers to health care, dismantled Social Security services, and brutal cuts to medical research," Clark said in a press release. "Donald Trump vowed to cut prices on day one and make life more affordable. Instead, at every term, he has rigged the system against working people. He cut trillions from health care, closed rural hospitals, and hiked insurance premium costs, all to lower taxes for the billionaire class. He implemented illegal tariffs that have devastated small businesses and driven up the cost of groceries, housing, insurance, and utilities," she said. MSNBC personalities Joy Reid and Kate Feng have been tapped to host the event, which will feature a lineup including Markey and fellow Democrat U.S. Senators Mark Lee, Democrat from Oregon, Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, Tina Smith, Democrat, New Mexico, Chris Van Hollen, Democrat, Maryland, numerous reps and other elected officials, leaders, advocates, and according to organizers. The State of the Union should be a reckoning with reality, but Donald Trump will use it to spin fiction and normalize the gross abuse of power. He will claim everything is fine while families struggle to afford health care and housing, immigrant communities live in fear, and his billionaire allies loot the country under the cover of chaos. I will not legitimize those lies, Markey said last week. Governor Maura Healey also issued a statement ahead of Trump's speech attacking the president and his focus on affordability in America. Affordability in Massachusetts, especially with soaring energy costs, along with high taxes and costly state climate policies, has posed the biggest reelection challenge to Healey for 2026. I wish tonight we could hear from a president who is focused on lowering costs, protecting people, and bringing steady leadership here and across the globe. But we are getting the exact opposite. This is a president who has declared that he's already won affordability, so we know his speech will be completely detached from the reality our families face and offer no plan to actually help them, Healey said in a written statement. The governor went on to highlight what she calls her economic accomplishments, also telling residents she is focused on you and what matters in your life. It starts with lowering costs. That means buildings or more homes to bring down housing costs. It means bringing more energy in, opposing rate hikes and lowering energy costs. We're capping health deductibles and co-pays to lower the cost of health care. We're making sure people can get the vaccines they need while President Trump tries to take them away. We're making our schools even better for our kids and creating jobs in every part of our state. And my job as governor is to protect people in our communities. That means protecting them from ICE. It's why I'm getting ICE out of our schools, hospitals, nursing homes, courthouses, and places of worship, and making sure people's rights are protected, said Healey. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said Trump will argue that Republicans are best suited to continue tackling the public's concerns about the cost of living. The president's going to make the case that three more years with him in the White House and with the Republicans on Capitol Hill, we can finally achieve the American dream in this country again that we had in his first term, but was lost because of Joe Biden and the Democrats over the past 4 years, Leavitt told reporters at the White House. The speech will also be a celebration of 250 years of America's independence, she said. Over to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Diane. Tariff ruling doesn't solve the problem. Bloomberg opinion. On the merits, the Supreme Court's decision last week to invalidate much of the president's global tariff regime is to be welcomed. Yet the court's judgment, sound as it might be on constitutional grounds, can't by itself undo the damage that Americans' turn to protectionism has already caused, nor prevent worse to come. Avoiding future harm will be entirely up to the administration and Congress. Unless they choose to put stability first, things could quickly spiral towards a crisis. By a 6-3 margin, the court found that the president had exceeded his authority when imposing a blizzard of high tariffs last year. It ruled that the law the administration had invoked, the International Emergency Economic Power Act, didn't explicitly authorize such measures in conferring the power to regulate trade. Other crucial questions were left unresolved, however, not the least whether the White House can replace the tariffs using other legal tools or if it can keep on declaring so-called emergencies to justify expansive executive power. Plans to replace the duties are already underway. In response to the ruling, the president said he'll impose a new global 15% tariff under Section 122 of the 1974 Trade Act and start investigations with a new view to impose more levies using different authorities. This leaves the outlook no clearer than before. In particular, firms that have paid the now illegal tariffs will seek redress. Whether refunds will be granted and how they'll be administered has been sent back to lower courts, with some $170 billion of government revenue at stake. Whatever the result of this future litigation, the government's fiscal calculations, which were already dubious, put it in generously to put it generously, have now been torn up. Budget deficits currently well above 5% of gross domestic product will likely to keep growing despite more than $250 billion a year in expected future tariff revenue. Cutting off that income creates an economic gap, and even the most expansive use of alternative authorities is unlikely to bridge it. In other words, the economy faces a new and potentially massive fiscal shock. As if all this weren't worrying enough, there's yet another danger as the administration ponders the stinging defeat. If the president's efforts to reimpose tariffs by other means meets with further resistance from the court, an open possibility given the narrowness of last week's ruling, he might turn his anger on the justices, in much the same way he has tried to intimidate the Federal Reserve. In that event, the court would be drawn into a struggle over who's in charge. The government's setback on tariffs might become a fiscal emergency, real, not imagined, on an economic body blow and a constitutional crisis all in one. It's vital that wiser heads prevail. The administration should, at the very least, soften its approach to trade, seeking new agreements with trading partners and dispensing with any future tariff threats. It should work with Congress to start restoring fiscal control with orderly spending, discipline, broad-based increases in revenue, and a workable bipartisan target for future deficits. And it should struggle to contain its fury over a Supreme Court that just shot down its signature policy. Just now, such advice may sound like asking for the moon, but dismissing it, consider the alternatives. Diane.
Okay, Bill Rick, a PD, received certification for the first time. Out of Marlboro, multiple area police departments were recognized in a ceremony last week for meeting certification and accreditation standards set by the Massachusetts Police Accreditation Commission, with the Billerica Police Department receiving certification for the first time in its history. Municipal police departments can be certified by MPAC through a self-initiated evaluation process for police departments to meet and maintain high standards for their application of law enforcement. For a department to get certification from MPAC, it must meet 178 mandatory standards, be willing to submit to regular assessment by MPAC-appointed assessors to confirm continued compliance, and agree to correct any policies or behavior that fall short of those standards. The standards for certification include, among many others, maintaining up-to-date policies on jurisdiction and mutual aid, proper collection and preservation of evidence, actual working conditions, crime analysis, communication, community involvement, and the departure's financial management. This accomplishment took a tremendous amount of commitment from many individuals at the Billerica Police Department, said Billerica Police Chief Roy Frost. We believe that MPAC certification standards will ensure that best practices are applied and maintained throughout our organization. The result of this commitment is a safer community and a better police department. I'm so proud of each of my officers who directly contributed to this prestigious accomplishment. Billerica Police Department began this process in December of 2023 when Frost put Officer Dan Casey in charge of the effort. Casey, an administrative lieutenant, Robert Beloyne, coordinated the effort together over the next 2 years, culminating in a February 17th ceremony at the Marlboro Country Club, where Billerica and other police departments in Massachusetts receive certifications and accreditations, the latter of which carries an even higher standard. The UMass Lowell Police Department received certification alongside Billerica, while the Groton Police Department received re-accreditation. Accreditation is considered the next step after certification, requiring departments to meet a larger set of policy standards in addition to the standard required for certification. Achieving accreditation demonstrates our commitment to delivering an exemplary level of police service to the town of Groton. Accreditation is an achievement and was a department-wide effort, said Groton Police Department in a statement on their Facebook page February 18th. Police Chief Michael Luth would like to specially thank our accreditation managers, Sergeant Gemos and Sergeant Kandow, for their tireless work on this process over the last few years. First achieving certification in September of 2021, become accredited in the first time for the first time in 2023 and now achieving reaccreditation in 2026. The Billerica and UMass Lowell Police are among 14 departments in the state to currently meet the certification standards. There are 121 departments which currently meet the accreditation standards, which also include Chelmsford, Littleton, Lowell, Tewksbury, Westford, and Wilmington. Over to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Diane. New Hampshire leaders must show political courage. To the editor, this is an open letter to New Hampshire Governor Kelly Agut and members of the New Hampshire legislature. If you defend or excuse or are silent in the face of ICE or CBP's conduct and tactics, especially after the two murders in Minneapolis and using a five-year-old child as bait, you are not only un-American, you have no conscience or moral center. If you welcome ICE or CBP into New Hampshire, you are part of the societal and moral chaos they bring and represent. You are not defending the rule of law, but enforcing the law of lawlessness. The rule of lawlessness. Live up to your oath. Demonstrate political courage and a moral spine. That will be a worthy legacy. This is from Greg Davis of Salem. Okay. Next piece. Let's find common ground on kindergarten. To the editor. We chose Londonderry for their great schools, where we did not have full-day kindergarten. I thought a town like Londonderry, with a reputation for pride in their schools, would soon be on board. Surely, Lancer Nation would take care of its littlest learners, too. After two failed votes, I am in disbelief that this is the same town that once considered Moose Hill a shining example of their dedication to their students. But what worked 25 years ago is not what works for kids and families today. Luckily, we still have an amazing staff dedicated to our kids and administration and school board willing to fight for them. They kept at this because they know it's important to have a full, uninterrupted day of learning to give our kids the foundation they need for a successful educational journey. While we leave a great space behind, its essence will continue on because those same teachers will still be there to usher our kids into this new phase like they've always done. Now they would just get more of them. This is common ground to be found here. There is common ground to be found here where parents get something important for their children. The district continues to offer a top-level education, something I know Londonderry values at its core, all while preventing a major expense to taxpayers. This new proposal is that common ground. Let's come together as one Lancer Nation and bring our entire school system up to the standards of today. This is from Kelly Dingham of Londonderry. Diane.
Okay, planting beans and garlic with Emily Macrez. Out of Townsend, while we still have a few more weeks of winter here in New England, it's not too early to start thinking about spring gardens. The Townsend Public Library will help gardeners get a head start with the program titled Growing Beans and Garlic at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, February 25th at the library at 12 Dudley Road. This informative program hosted by Emily Macrez of F Word Farm, Farming, Foraging, Fermenting, will walk participants through the essentials of growing two of her favorite garden favorites. This class is all about my obsession with beans, how beautiful they are, how to grow them, why they are good for us and the soil, and ways to use them, said Marquez. I will also teach another favorite of mine to grow, garlic. Growing beans and garlic will cover what to think about when selecting seeds, when to plant, and how to use your harvest. Participants will learn which bean varieties thrive in local conditions and how to plant, harvest, and store garlic for year-round use. The program is designed to be practical and beginner-friendly, offering tips that can be used in backyard gardens or small growing spaces. Mark Rez, owner of F Word Farm, is an educator on all things fermenting, farming, and foraging related. F Word Farm was started out of a love for the environment, McRez said. It's an earth-centered farm that practices organic, no-till farming focused on building ecosystems and soil. The event is free and open to the public, though registration is required. For more information or to register, visit the Townsend Public Library's website at Townsend library.org or call 978-549-7379 for more information. Over to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Diane. Haverhill earns $50,000 for opioid prevention work. Haverhill is included in a $1.25 million funding package to strengthen the state's opioid prevention and recovery efforts. The award was announced last week through the second round of the Mosaic Opioid Recover Partnership's Municipal Matching Grant Program, providing more than $1 million in matching funds to 18 applicants representing 69 municipalities statewide. Haverhill's grant for $50,000 will support a community-driven prevention strategy focused on youth and families. The city plans to use the funding to engage youth, family, and community partners in developing a shared prevention approach. The approach includes launching a youth action team, conducting a community needs assessment, and co-creating a bilingual resource guide designed to strengthen resilience and reduce the risk of substance abuse. Senator Barry Feingold took to Facebook last week to deliver the news that Haverhill would be receiving the $50,000 grant. The Mosaic program is powered by Boston's RIZE, Massachusetts Foundation, a nonprofit organization founded in 2017 and dedicated to ending the overdose crisis in the state, a goal of zero stigma and zero deaths. RIZE is funded by the State Department of Public Health's Bureau of Substance Addiction Services. The drug crisis continues to affect the Merrimack Valley as Haverhill recorded 25 opioid-related overdose deaths in 2023. In Lawrence, 42 opioid-related overdose deaths were reported that same year, according to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. In Essex County, there were 217 opioid-related overdose deaths in 2023, while statewide the total surpassed 2,000. Lawrence has also benefited from the Mosaic program through prior rounds of funding. A previous $50,000 grant was awarded to Lawrence/Methuen Community Coalition, a partnership that provides transportation to treatment centers for individuals connected with the Lawrence Hub. The Psychological Center, Inc., also based in Lawrence, had previously received a $150,000 grant covering 2024 through 2027 from this program. RIZE has reported that Massachusetts has secured more than $900 million through legal actions against companies for their role in the opioid crisis. These funds are set to be distributed over the next 18 years, with 40% awarded directly to municipalities and 60% directed to the state's Opioid Recovery and Remediation Fund. So far, RIZE has awarded about $14 million in opioid settlement funds via the Mosaic program. We are committed to ensuring that the dollars are invested and remain in the communities most deeply impacted by the crisis and in organizations that center the voice of people with lived and living experience, RIZE wrote online. Diane.
Okay, Merrimack Valley in a minute. Excuse me, out of Lowell. Lowell Alliance and Coalition for a Better Acre are hosting the 10th year of Empower Building Leaders Strengthening Communities, an interactive 9-week grassroots leadership program that runs Wednesdays from March 25th through May 20th. Any resident of Lowell or person who works in Lowell is welcome to apply to the non-cost program. The Empower program provides Lowell's establishment and aspiring leaders with the knowledge and skills needed to organize as a community, advocate for change, and take action to address issues in and around the city. Many of these workshops are facilitated by local leaders, including previous Empowered graduates. Workshop topics include the history of Lowell and the power of organizing in Lowell, considering and addressing race, power, and privilege, how City Hall works and how to make it work for you, organizing for change, project planning and implementation. Applications are due by Friday, February 27th. For more information, contact Liz Anusakakis by emailing. I'm going to have to spell this. By emailing at EANUSAUSKAS at YWCA of Lowell.org. It's a mouthful. Out of Chelmsford, SHINE, Serving Health Information Needs of Everyone, is a health benefits counseling program sponsored by AgeSpan, which provides a trained health benefit counselor. The purpose of the program is to ensure that people have access to accurate, unbiased information regarding health insurance. The SHINE program provides free health insurance information, counseling, and assistance to all Massachusetts residents with Medicare age 65 plus. Appointments can be made with a counselor by calling the Senior Center at 978-251-0533. Again, out of Lowell, save the date. Ireland flag raising. In addition to the flags customarily flown at JFK Plaza, the city commemorates flags from many countries and for special events during the year. On Sunday, March 8th, from 11 a.m. to noon, the public is invited to a flag-raising ceremony in celebration of Ireland. The outdoor event is held in front of City Hall at 375 Merrimack Street. For a list of flag-raising dates, to schedule a flag-raising ceremony at City Hall, submit an application to the Office of Cultural Affairs and Special Events 3 to 4 weeks prior to the date of the flag-raising. For more information, call 978-674-1482. And lastly, out of Lowell, the community nonprofit Love All, Serve All hosts its semi-annual free medical and health screening clinic on Saturday, April 11th, from 8:30 to 2:30 at Cy Unity Center, 4 Old Ferry Road. Doctors from a variety of disciplines, internal medicine, pediatrics, mental health, endocrinology, cardiology, optometry, and physical and occupational therapy will be on site to provide free health care. Services include free blood sugar, cholesterol and blood pressure testing, cancer awareness screenings, nutrition counseling, and a dental checkup with fluoride treatment. Pharmacy prescriptions will not be provided. Free reading glasses and dental hygiene kits will be distributed. COVID and flu vaccines will also be provided. Participants should bring a list of medications taken regularly. Insurance coverage is not required, but on-site MassHealth registration is available. LASA Foundation is a charitable organization dedicated to undertaking community service, educational, spiritual, and devotional activities. LASA is free, no denomination. Voluntary organizations whose members come from all faiths and share a common goal. For further information, call 978-710-4012. Over to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Diane. Wyndham Woods plans athletic dome for students' community. Wyndham, a proposed 125,000-square-foot athletics dome at Wyndham Woods School could bring year-round sports, national tournaments, and more than 100,000 annual visitors to town while expanding opportunities for students and the broader community. If approved by town officials, the $9.1 million project will become the largest and most highly visited year-round multi-sport and fitness facility in New England. Plans call for baseball and volleyball courts, pickleball and street hockey courts, a multi-sport turf field, golf simulators and athletic training and weight room, a sky deck performance cardio center, a children's playground, and a cafe. The space would host competitive sporting events, corporate outings, trade shows, special events, and private functions. The school officials say $4.3 million has already been committed as of October, largely through private donors and more than 60 corporate partnerships. The project will be completed at no cost to taxpayers. This is incredibly exciting for Wyndham, said Tom Murray, Wyndham resident and CEO of Poglia's Contracting Construction. As someone who has been deeply involved in school projects for years, I can honestly say opportunities like this don't come around often. A facility like this, right here in our community, privately financed, is a huge win. For Ryan DeJoy, founding member and head of school at Wyndham Woods, the dome represents the next phase in the project's rapid growth and is a critical investment for the student experience, he said. Wyndham Woods services 208 students in grades 1 through 12 from 91 cities and towns across Massachusetts and New Hampshire. The private school focuses on students with mild to moderate learning challenges, including dyslexia, ADHD, language impairments, and school-related anxiety. Its hands-on individualized model is designed for students who learn best by doing, DeJoy said. Since opening in 2019 with 46 students and 14 faculty members, the school has expanded dramatically, adding more than 35,000 square feet of classroom and learning space and growing to 107 faculty members and 49 learning spaces. However, the campus was not originally designed as a traditional school, and lacks a gymnasium and other athletic infrastructure. There isn't a gym here, there isn't a field, there isn't a court, DeJoy said. If students wanted to participate in competitive athletics, they had to return to their home districts. The Dome changed that dynamic for students. It will allow students to join teams, develop leadership skills, and explore new sports in a supportive environment, while also providing option after school and weekend opportunities for students to assist with facility operations during community rental hours, giving them hands-on experience in communication, organization, and customer service. The facility is designed with flexibility in mind, offering 16 sporting configurations and events capabilities, DeJoy said. When not in use by Wyndham Woods students, it will be available for rent by local school districts, businesses, and organizations. DeJoy expects it will also attract tournaments and special events from across New England. The school, 39 Ralston Road, secured property at 41 Range Road, less than 2 minutes from campus, to build a dome on an off-campus site that's both more visible and build ready, DeJoy said. Planning for the project began in 2024, with floor plans finalized and Murray secured as contractor by December of that year. The capital campaign launched in January 2025, followed by site plan development and architectural renderings by that spring. Pending town approvals, construction could begin immediately, with completion projected for later this year. Selectman Bruce Britton, who has supported the school for several years, called the campus a hidden treasure and said the dome is a strong for both campus and the community. This helps kids who have a hard time learning. The people there are great and the students are incredibly polite, he said. Having year-round sports will make the school even better, and when they're not using it, the community can. Wyndham Schools was founded in 2019 after a local family donated nearly 250 acres of land and a building to establish the students with struggling to find the right educational fit, DeJoy said. Having spent nearly two decades in education as an administrator and an educator, he assembled a funding team in 2018 and opened the school the following year. The school's first year coincided with the COVID-19 pandemic, yet demand remains strong. Each expansion has focused on adding classroom space to meet enrollment growth, and the dome marks the campus's next evolution, ensuring students will have access to the same extracurricular and athletic opportunities available in traditional school settings, while strengthening ties to the Wyndham community. This is unique and exciting, DeJoy said. I think a lot of times something like this, especially in the education world, people don't endeavor to take something like this on because it's really daunting. But it's an incredible opportunity to give deserving kids what they need and what will help them feel good about where they are in school. That's the most important part. And when you extrapolate from there, members of the Wyndham community will have access to this facility. It's a win-win for everybody. Okay, it is time for our mid-show break. We will be back in a few minutes.
Okay,
we are back. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. And treasure trove for the past 85 years, Andover. The items found at the Andover thrift shop over the last 85 years, such as a worn tete-a-tete chair, a 1944 wedding dress, and grandma's favorite china, all carry their someone else's story. Andover Thrift Shop, 10 Park Street, celebrates its 85th anniversary this month as a hometown source for recycled home goods and clothing in the spirit of giving back to the community. It was February 1941 when the Christ Episcopal Church gave a $50 loan to a group of women volunteers in an effort to open the shop to support the church. Proceeds from the shop have funded all the maintenance of the historic buildings at the Christ Church on Central Street and benefits other local causes. Managers Missy Blanche and Becky Dempsey run the organization's shop along with about 50 volunteers who sort through donations and put out new inventory every day for the loyal customers who line up outside at noon when the shop opens. They were sort of pioneers in what they were doing for the church and helping people afford different goods when maybe otherwise they couldn't, Blanche said, about the woman who started the shop. In that era, she said, people made sure nothing went to waste, including clothing and housewares. It was very much a thing of that time period and another way to recycle stuff, so why not find a good outlet for it, Blanche said about thrifting. In 85 years, the shop has seen people from all walks of life come through its front door downtown, whether that was its original location on Post Office Avenue or its fourth spot on Park Street, home since 1964. Customers come from all over the Merrimack Valley and all ages. It's become a popular spot for high school and college students to drop into on off days. Everyone shops at and thrift shops, Dempsey said. Staff has seen its customer base value the premise behind the thrifting to reuse and recycle clothing to help preserve the environment. We get people who have need to have lower priced items, but we also have a fan base of people who just want a good bargain, Dempsey said. No 2 days are the same at the Andover Thrift Shop, as workers say they never know what donations will meet them at the back door. People just walk in the back door all day long, Blanche said with a laugh. Donors and customers all have a story and want to share theirs when they drop off items or browse the racks. Donors tell the stories behind their grandparents' fine china or a garment they are parting ways with because they are either moving, downsizing, or purging, or a loved one has died. Though letting go can be hard for some people, Dempsey said, these are people's family heirlooms. We get a lot of people who come here and ask if we will take grandma's china because a direct relative doesn't want it anymore, Blanche said. There are people out there who do want it, and we try to reassure them that there are people who will appreciate the items and it will find a good home. Items that cannot be sold get donated to organizations such as the Epilepsy Foundation, the MSPCA in Methuen, Community Giving Tree, Habitat for Humanity's Restore, Lazarus House, and various shelters and senior centers in the Merrimack Valley. Volunteers worked diligently behind the scenes on a recent Tuesday to tag items before heading to the floor. The thrift shop's regulars come in several times a week because of the constant flow of merchandise. Blanche said the hunt for treasures for good price is half the fun. But it's because of the volunteers that the shop has built a vibrant community with its customers. Some volunteers have helped at Andover Thrift Shop for more than two decades. It's a great community of loving, giving, and kind people, Blanche said. This is a very special place and has been for a long time. Diane.
Okay. Hegseth warns Anthropic to let military use company's AI as it sees fit, AP sources say. Excuse me, out of Washington, D.C., forgive me today, my voice is very scratchy. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave Anthropic CEO a Friday deadline to open the company's artificial intelligence technology for unrestricted military use or risk losing its government contract, according to a person familiar with their meeting Tuesday. Anthropic makes the Cabot Claude and is the last of its peers to not supply its technology to a new U.S. military internal network. CEO Dario Amodei repeatedly has made clear his ethical concerns about unchecked government use of AI, including the dangers of fully autonomous armed drones and of AI-assisted mass surveillance that could track dissent. Defense officials warned that they would designate Anthropic a supply chain risk or use the Defense Production Act to essentially give the military more authority to use its products even if it doesn't approve of how they are used, according to the person familiar with the meeting and a senior Pentagon official, who both were not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. The development, which is reported earlier by Axios, underscores the debate over AI's role in national security and concerns about how the technology could be used in high-stakes situations involving lethal force, sensitive information, or government surveillance. It also comes as Hegseth has vowed to root out what he calls a woke culture in the armed forces. A powerful AI looking across billions of conversations from millions of people could gouge public sentiment, detect pockets of disloyalty forming, and stamp them out before they grow, Amati wrote in an essay last month. The person familiar called the tone of the meeting cordial, but also said Amati didn't budge on two areas he has established as lines Anthropic won't cross. Full autonomous military targeting operations and domestic surveillance of U.S. citizens. The Pentagon objects to Anthropic's ethical restrictions because military operations need tools that don't come with built-in limitations, the senior Pentagon official said. The official argued that the Pentagon has only issued lawful orders and stressed that using Anthropic's tools legally would be the military's responsibility. The Pentagon announced last summer that it was awarding defense contracts to four AI companies, Anthropic, Google, OpenAI, and Elon Musk's XAI. Each contract is worth up to $200 million. Anthropic was the first AI company to get approved for classified military networks, where it works with partners like Palantir. Musk's XAI company, which operates the Grok chatbot, says Grok also is ready to be used in classified settings, according to the senior Pentagon official. The officials noted that other AI companies were close to the milestone. SpaceX, Musk's spaceflight company that recently merged with XAI, didn't immediately return a request for comment Tuesday. Hegseth said in January, speech at SpaceX in South Texas, that he was shrugging off any AI models that won't allow you to fight wars. Hegseth said his vision for military AI systems means that they operate without ideological constraints that limit lawful military applications, before adding that the Pentagon's AI will not be woke. The defense secretary said that Grok would join the secure but unclassified Pentagon AI network called GNAI.mil. The announcement came days after Grok, which is embedded into X, the social media network owned by Musk, drew global scrutiny for generating highly sexualized deepfake images of people without their consent. OpenAI announced in early February that it too would join GenAI.mil, enabling service members to use a custom version of ChatGPT for unclassified tasks. Anthropic said in a statement after Tuesday's meeting that it continued good faith conversations about our usage policy to ensure Anthropic can continue to support the government's national security mission in line with what our models can reliably and responsibly do. Anthropic has long pitched itself as the more responsible and safety-minded of the leading AI companies ever since its founder quit OpenAI to form the startup in 2021. Excuse me. The uncertainty with the Pentagon is putting those intentions to the test, according to Owen Daniels, Associated Director of Analysis and Fellow at Georgetown University Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Anthropic's peers, including Meta, Google, and XAI, have been willing to comply with department's policies on using models for all lawful applications, Daniel said. So the company's bargaining power here is limited, and it risks losing influence in the department's push to adopt AI. In the AI craze that followed the release of ChatGPT, Anthropic closely aligned with President Joe Biden's Democratic administration in volunteering to subject its AI systems to third-party scrutiny to guard against national security risks. Amodi, the CEO, has warned of AI's potentially catastrophic dangers while rejecting the label that he's an AI doomer. He argued in the January essay that we're considerably close to real danger in 2026 than we were in 2023, but those risks would be managed in a realistic, pragmatic manner. Anthropic has been at odds with Trump, with the Trump administration. This would not be the first time Anthropic's advocacy for stricter AI safeguards has put it at odds with President Donald's Trump administration. Anthropic needled chip maker NVIDIA publicly criticizing Trump's proposal to lose export controls to enable some AI computer chips to be sold in China. The AI company, however, remains a close partner with NVIDIA. Trump's Republican administration and Anthropic also have been on opposite sides of a lobbying push to regulate AI in the United States. Trump's top AI advisor, David Sachs, accused Anthropic in October of running a sophisticated regulatory capture strategy based on fear-mongering. Sachs was responding on X to Anthropic co-founder Jack Clark, writing about his attempt to balance technology optimism with an appropriate fear about the steady march towards more capable AI systems. Anthropic hired a number of ex-Biden officials soon after Trump's return to the White House, but it also tried to signal a bipartisan approach. The company recently added Chris Lydon, a former White House official from Trump's first term, to its board of directors. The Pentagon breakneck adoption of AI shows the need for greater AI oversight or regulation by Congress, particularly if AI is being used to surveil Americans, said Amos Toe, senior counselor at Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program at New York University. The law is not keeping up with how quickly the technology is evolving, Toe wrote in a post on Blue Sky, but that doesn't mean Doody has a blank check. I don't know what Doody is. O'Brien reported from Providence, Rhode Island. So that's the end of that article.
All right. Thank you, Diane.
Yep.
Andover, a $15.5 million bridge product in its final design stage, has garnered the support of the Select Board as the Massachusetts Department of Transportation continues to move the endeavor along. And this is about a Tewksbury Street bridge replacement in Andover. The Select Board unanimously voted Monday that its support of the Tewksbury Street Bridge replacement project be shared with MassDOT. Sam Campbell and Michael Shustak of Greenman Pedersen Inc., GPI, presented the request for support of the project along with a de minimis, whatever that is, determination for the permanent and temporary easements on the Shawshene River Conservation Area next to the Tewksbury Street Bridge along during construction. MassDOT hired GPI, a transportation and engineering firm, to design the project. The Tewksbury Street Bridge, which spans railroad tracks operated by CSX Corp., will be fully replaced when the project is completed. MassDOT is expected to invest $15.5 million in the project. Construction and utility work are anticipated to begin in stages in 2027 and conclude in 2030. Bridge construction is slated to begin between April and August 2028. The bridge was built in 1980. Its concrete beams are in severe deterioration, which caused the bridge to be shut down in 2018, Shustak said. Temporary support towers were added in order to reopen the bridge. It remains open with a weight restriction and vehicles resisted to one-way alternative traffic with a signal. The new bridge will restore two-way traffic and widen it to include a shoulder that accommodates bicyclists. MassDOT sought support from the Select Board because of the effect to the Shawshene River Conservation Area. The parcel of land, 7.42 acres at 126 Tewksbury Street, only the front of the property will be affected, and it won't change access to the land how it is used by the public. The property was once owned by Richold Chemicals, Inc. The Section 4F property in relation to the project is publicly owned area of conservation land. Before approving the project, it approves a portion of this type of property. The Federal Highway Administration has to determine there are no other alternatives that would avoid impacts to Section 4F conservation land or can determine the use is of a de minimis nature with minor impacts, Campbell said. This type of impact won't adversely affect activities or features of the property in question. Proposed impacts include temporary easements to allow for grading and erosion control associated with the bridge replacement, Campbell said. Permanent easements would include a utility pole upgraded and bridge slope paving. The total easements would take up less than 1% of the total property. The project is in its final stage of design, and the right-of-way plan has been accepted by MassDOT. The bridge will have a 5.5-foot sidewalk and bicycle accommodations with two lanes when done. Work on Old Tewksbury Street at its intersection and with Tewksbury Street, in addition to extending the Yardley Street and Pinecone Lane intersections, is also planned. The goal is to replace the bridge with a safer and more functional one. It will also improve roadway safety by flattening out the approaches to improve the sight distances over the bridge. The bridge is at a high point in the road, which limits the sight distances of drivers crossing the bridge, causing a potentially unsafe condition, Shostak said. There is also exposed and broken steel reinforcement underneath the bridge and deterioration to the beam's pier cap. There will be staged demolition and construction to maintain the existing traffic pattern over the bridge, which will allow it to remain open for almost the entire project while it's replaced. Damaged drainage infrastructure, the water main, and overhead utilities in the area will also be updated. MassDOT previously held a design hearing for the bridge work in May 2025. Because it contains land protected by Massachusetts Article 97, MassDOT will also need to go through the state legislature and Conservation Commission to make sure it has all the appropriate permissions to establish a small easement there, Town Council Doug Yim said. Diane.
Okay, New Hampshire resident charged in shooting at Canadian border. Out of Concord, New Hampshire, authorities have charged a New Hampshire resident in connection with a shooting that occurred at the state border with Canada, federal prosecutors said Tuesday. Blue Zeke Daly, 26, who also goes by Cullen Zeke Daly of Manchester, was charged with one count of attempted murder of a federal officer and one count of assaulting a federal officer with a deadly weapon, prosecutors said. Daly was shot near the border early Sunday by a U.S. Border Patrol agent who was returning fire from Daly, investigators said Monday. Daly is at a hospital receiving medical treatment under guard, prosecutors said. The Border Patrol agent, whom authorities have not named, was unharmed, authorities said earlier this week. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation has said shots were fired around 1 p.m. Sunday in Pittsburgh, a town of about 800 people at the border with Canada. The U.S. Attorney's Office for District of New Hampshire said Tuesday that a Border Patrol agent encountered Daly driving alone near the border late Saturday and followed Daly for a distance. Daly then arrived at the Pittsburgh port of entry, which was closed at the time. The Border Patrol agent activated his emergency lights and exited his vehicle, at which point Daly started to turn. Daly then fired a handgun at the Border Patrol agents. The agent returned fire with his own service weapon and shot Daly, the U.S. Attorney Office said in a statement. It was unclear Tuesday night if Daly had an attorney. Prosecutors said the case is still under investigation and the FBI is taking the lead. Pittsburgh is a rural community that is home to the state's sole border crossing with the Canadian province of Quebec. It's about 150 miles north of the state capital of Concord. The town borders Maine and Vermont as well as Canada. All right, today in history, 1870, Republican Hiram R. Revels of Mississippi was sworn in as U.S. Senator, becoming the first African-American member of either House of Congress. In 1913, the 16th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, giving Congress the power of levy and collect income taxes, was declared in effect by Secretary of State Philander Chase Knox. In 1956, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, I think, railed for hours against the brutality and cult of personality of his late predecessor, dictator Joseph Stalin, in a speech to the Communist Party Congress. In 1964, Muhammad Ali became world heavyweight boxing champion for the first time as he defeated Sonny Liston in Miami Beach. In 1986, President Ferdinand Marcos fled the Philippines after 20 years of rule in the wake of a detained election. Opposition leader Corazon Aquino, the first woman to lead the country, assumed the presidency. In 1991, during the Gulf War, 28 American soldiers were killed when an Iraqi Scuttle missile hit a U.S. barracks in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia. In 1994, American-born Jewish settler Baruch Goldstein opened fire with an automatic rifle inside the Tomb of the Patriarchs in the West Bank during the Islamic holy month of Ramadan, killing 29 Muslims before he was beaten to death by worshippers. In 1997, a jury in Media, Pennsylvania, convicted chemical fortune heir John E. DuPont of third-degree murder, deciding he was mentally ill when he shot and killed world-class wrestler David Schultz. DuPont died in prison in December of 2010 while serving 13 to 30-year sentence. He was 72 years old. In 2024, the U.S. and Britain struck 18 Houthi targets in Yemen, answering a recent surge in attacks by the Iran-backed militia group on ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, including a missile strike that set fire to cargo vessels. Over to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Diane. Medical group home opens in Groveland. A Peabody-based human services agency has stretched its impact in town with the opening of a fully accessible medical residential program. The program, operated by Bridgewell, Inc., is designed to serve people with significant developmental and physical disabilities. Bridgewell recently opened the home on Birchwood Terrace, the organization's first program in Groveland. The one-story residence, renovated by Cornerstone Construction, is equipped to serve people with medical needs and features nursing staff available to provide around-the-clock care. The home has a capacity of 4 residents, according to Marlene Velez, residential director at Bridgewell. While no residents are living there yet, Bridgewell expects a move-in date shortly. The organization hosted an open house on Feb 11 to introduce the program to neighbors and community members of Groveland. Christopher Tuttle, Bridgewell president and CEO, attended alongside nearby residents Joe and Marge Pelkar, local officials and representatives from the State Department of Developmental Services, also toured the newly refurbished space. "We're opening the doors to the community and the neighbors," Velez said. "The idea is for our people to feel like part of the community and basically be a family." The nonprofit organization provides specialized support services for people with development disorders throughout northeastern Massachusetts, with programs in Peabody and Lynn. The Groveland residence represents the group's effort to expand care across the region for those requiring intensive medical support. Bridgewell is funded through DDS. People may apply for services through DDS and, if eligible, could be referred to one of Bridgewell's residential programs. More information is available at bridgewell.org. Diane.
Okay, letters to the editor. The current tug of war over public funds highlights a glaring double standard in our leadership. Attorney General Andrea Campbell, with Governor Healey's backing, has recently sued 9 communities, including Tewksbury and Wilmington, for noncompliance with the MBTA Communities Act. Their justification? That state law is mandatory and housing grants must be withheld as a penalty for local defiance. Yet these same leaders express outrage when the federal government applies that exact logic to them. President Trump has threatened to withhold significant federal funding from Massachusetts over its sanctuary policies. specifically the state's refusal to allow state police to share non-citizen data with ICE during driver license applications. Our state leaders cannot have it both ways. They cannot treat municipal autonomy as a nuisance to be crushed by withholding grants while simultaneously claiming that federal funding for the state should be unconditional despite their own defiance of federal immigration priorities. If the governor believes the law is the law for small towns, she must acknowledge the same pressure from Washington. Consistency, not selective enforcement, is the only way to restore public trust in our governance. Signed, George Ferdinand of Tewksbury, Mass. And then we have absolutely fabulous article on the women in 1940s working at Atlantic Parachute in Lowell. Thank you for this very interesting and informing article, signed Linda Poirier of Tewksbury, Mass. It has been reported that our state leader wants the local and state police to not cooperate with ICE to remove illegal criminals from the state, and Boston's city leader feels the same way. So I guess they have no problem that the residents in our state have been living next door with criminals. And if anyone wonders why people are moving out of our state, all you have to do is check your recent energy bills and real estate taxes. And if there's a problem with pedestrian crashes with cars in our area, you have to ask yourself if these crashes are caused by drivers simply not watching where they're driving. The penalty for distracted driving is way, way too lenient. $100 is a joke. Signed, Ken Sanders of Lowell, Massachusetts. A recent move to expand access to non-dairy milk and school lunch programs is a long overdue step with healthier, more inclusive nutrition. Millions of students are lactose intolerant, allergic to dairy, or come from families that avoid animal products for ethical or cultural reasons. Offering plant-based milk isn't radical, it's practical. These options provide essential nutrients without the saturated fat and cholesterol found in dairy, and they come with a much smaller environmental footprint. School meals shape lifelong habits. When we normalize plant-based choices early, we teach children that compassion, health, and sustainability can coexist on the same tray. In a time when childhood health concerns and climate anxieties are rising, modernizing school nutrition just makes sense. Giving students plant-based options empowers families, respects differences, and quietly models a kinder way forward. One lunch at a time, signed Liam Melson of Lowell, Massachusetts. Residents and motorists will follow with interest the construction of the new Lowell Connector roundabout at the roadway's intersection with Gorham Street. For anyone driving on the connector, its sudden, abrupt ending at T intersects with Gordon Street is a puzzle. Why would the state have chosen to have a limited access, high-speed roadway end in this fashion? The track record of accidents over the years is eloquent testimony to its less than ideal configuration. So why exactly did such a set of circumstances come to be? For those readers not of a certain age or perhaps new to arrive in Lowell, a bit of history may be in welcome order. The original design of the Lowell Connector, generated in the 1950s, was much greater in scope, and the existing T intersection of Gorham Street was never originally intended. Originally, the connector had been designed to pass over Gorham Street on a bridge. It would have blasted through the narrow, compact streets of Lowell South End, gone through Hosford Square, and continued down to Lawrence Street. There, it would have angled to the left and progressed on its path, taking every piece of property in the strip of land between Lawrence Street and the Concord River. At Church Street, it would have again crossed on a bridge. The vulnerable 1848-era Fairgreave building would have been demolished, followed by the Bagshaw Mill building. The connector would then have crossed the Concord River and taken the office building at Davidson and Howe Streets, then most of the office space along East Merrimack Street. That would have come the crown jewel of the traffic engineer's brainstorm. Our beloved Memorial Auditorium would not have been reduced to rubble. Continuing on its course like some monster in an H.G. Wells novel, the connector would have crossed the Concord River again, passed through what is now Jack Kerouac's Park, but was then huge Coran Morton Warehouse, and finally would have funneled all its traffic down onto French Street and Father Morissette Boulevard. The idea was that would would have been able to drive from Kearney Square downtown right out to Route 3 and 495 without stopping at a single traffic light. Fortunately, cooler heads prevailed. Project was downsized. Dozens of properties were spared from the wrecking ball. The limited access connector was brought to its ignominious end, and we now see with traffic lights at Gorin Street. The early track record of panic stops and crashes show that solution for the hasty, ill-advised promise that it was. The sheer volume of vehicles, especially at rush hour, will be its toughest test. The merging of northbound Gorham Street traffic with incoming connector traffic may prove problematic. Pedestrian crossings, as shown in the designer's drawings in the recent Lowell Sun article, could conceivably cause backups that didn't previously exist. Still, there is no foolproof perfect solution to this decades-long vexing problem. If all goes well and everyone is lucky, it should at least be an improvement over what we have there now, and for that we can be thankful. Signed, J.F. Dacey of Lowell, Massachusetts. Over to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Diane. Dem hopefuls making pitches for party support. Boston. A crowded field of Democrats are clamoring for support from the party faithful as they seek the nomination to run for the wide-open 6th congressional district in the midterm elections. Democratic Representative Seth Moulton's decision to run for the U.S. Senate has created a rare congressional seat opening, and 7 Democrats are vying for the party's nomination to run in November's general election. For weeks, the hopefuls have been crisscrossing the sprawling congressional district to make their pitches at local party forums in an effort to lock down support from delegates for their fledgling campaigns ahead of the state Democratic Party's nomination convention in May. In their pitches to the party faithful, the congressional hopefuls are focusing on key issues for the party, such as pushing back on the Trump administration's immigration policies, protections for LGBTQ and transgender individuals, and cuts in federal health care spending. During an online forum Monday, hosted by Salem Democratic Committee, several of the candidates made their cases to local party members. Mariah Lancaster, a Salem veterinarian, former State Department official and congressional aide making her first run for elected office, said she has seen firsthand how fundamentally broken our healthcare systems are, both for our pets and for us. In this moment of crisis, Congress is failing us, she said to party members, and it's up to us as Democrats and Americans to take action. To make like better for working people, we have to send working people to Congress. She said Democrats need to reshape the party to win back control of Congress and push through truly progressive change like universal health care, equitable access to child care and education, affordable housing, renewing energy, and environmental protection. We have to change the power to change our political system. But to do so, we must all take concrete, immediate action together to beat back this ways of fascism, she said. Rick Jackus, a former Moulton chief of staff, stressed more than a decade of experience in constituent work and his desire for public service that prompted him to drop out of college and volunteer for the City Year program. For me, this is all about public service. This is not about politics, he said in remarks. I didn't grow up wanting to run for office. We didn't talk about politics at the dinner table. Jacobs of Swampscott highlighted his work for Moulton's office as district director and chief of staff, overseeing constituent services and other often behind-the-scenes work while helping steer congressionally approved federal funding to the district. It means I woke up every morning thinking about improving the lives of people of the 39 cities and towns in this congressional district, he said. Representative Tram Nguyen, a Democrat of Andover, highlighted her family's journey to the United States from Vietnam and how it shaped her decision to become a civil rights attorney and state lawmaker. Democracy is not just an idea for me, she said in remarks. It's a promise that an immigrant family can arrive with $100 in their pockets, work hard, and live with dignity and get a fair shot at the American dream. but sadly, we're seeing this American dream slip away from so many, Nguyen said. So I'm running for Congress to keep that dream alive. We need champions and fighters who will stand with the people. But sadly, we're seeing this American dream slip away for... Sorry. Four-term lawmakers shouted how she flipped a Republican-held seat in 2018 after defeating then-incumbent Representative Jim Lyons, Republican of Andover, expanding the Democratic Party's supermajority in the State House of Representatives. In her pitch to Salem Democrats, former State Rep. Jamie Pulsito said she's making another run for Congress because the nation's elected leaders have lost touch with the people they were supposed to represent. I'm used to taking on tough fights, the Topsfield Democrat said during Monday's forum, ticking off a list of her work as a lawmaker and positions on key issues. We need leadership that doesn't go along and get along, and I can assure you that's not who I am. I'm ready to hit the ground running on day one. Bethany Andres Beck, a software engineer and activist from Middleton, also argues that Congress is out of touch with average Americans and wants to focus on issues that matter to voters. This isn't a game. Politics is how we decide how we want our lives to be, Andres Beck said during Monday's forum, and I want us to decide better. Others seeking the party's nomination to run for the 6th District are Dan Coe, a former Biden administration official from Andover, who ran for the 3rd Congressional District in 2018, Democratic primary, and Linfin businessman and lawyer John Bexia. The winner of the Democratic primary will likely face Republican Micah Jones, a U.S. Army veteran and lawyer from Essex, who launched his bid for the congressional seat earlier this month. So far, Jones hasn't drawn a GOP primary challenger. The 6th Congressional District, which includes most of Essex County and 8 towns in Middlesex County, has about 640,000 voters, according to Secretary of State William Gavin's office. Nearly 60% of them were registered as independent. Registered Democrats outnumber Republicans in the district by a wide margin. Democrats have held the congressional seat since 1996, when Democrat John Tierney narrowly beat incumbent Republican Peter Torkelson. Christian M. Wade covers the Massachusetts State House for North of Boston's media groups, newspapers, and websites. Diane.
All right, I think we're going to wrap up. Thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading services, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune into LAB Radio at the Lowell Association for the Blind.org. This has been John Luke and Diane. We thank you for listening. Be safe outside and be kind to one another. Have a great rest of your day.